Can you turn off the hockey game? I feel like you're not with us.
I'm here. I'll be turning the game off.
Okay. Welcome back to Voices from the Road. I'm Jennifer Robinson, and tonight I'm with Jessica and Ian, who are celebrating the 16th anniversary of the night or day that he proposed.
Night.
Day. No, it was nighttime. Evening-ish.
Sunset. Florida Beach.
Sunset. Mm-hmm. How did it happen?
Well, it took a while, first of all. It was supposed to be a nice sunset, romantic, on the beach engagement.
It was before you could Google, like, the time, the minute of the sunset.
Which is true. So I picked her up. I had this really good plan, but realized I need to kill about an hour and a half before the plan could actually start. So then I was like, well, what do you want to do? And I seemed pretty nonchalant and didn't seem like I actually had a plan. But I was trying to keep it cool. So I ended up taking her out for supper at, I think it was Chili's.
I can't remember where.
A nice romantic place, obviously.
It's been too long.
Applebee's. We had an Applebee's in Florida.
It might have been Applebee's.
I still think it was Chili's because it was my favorite restaurant.
Of course you would take her to your favorite restaurant.
I'm just kidding. No, I think it could have been Applebee's. It was on the 528. It doesn't matter. Well, maybe it does to some people. No, anyways.
It doesn't matter because you didn't even want to take me there. You were just trying to kill time.
Right. And what she didn't know is I actually had this like nice picnic that I actually made. There was star fruit in there. There was all sorts of really cool things that I had planned, but I still had an hour and a half before it happened. So I took her out for dinner. So then it came to trying to find a spot on the beach that was kind of, you know, secluded, not tons of people around. And the way it works in Florida is there's one main drag that kind of runs along parallel with the beach. And then there's all these dead end turns that you turn into and you can park. But anyway, so I pulled into probably about five or six of these, realizing they're full of cars. And so I'd pull in, oh, there's tons of people, back out. And at this point, I think Jessica was either confused, annoyed, or both.
Yeah, I was kind of annoyed because you had said, I'm going to pick you up and I have this great night planned. And then you picked me up and you're like, so what do you want to do?
That was classic. Yeah, so, and I mean, you got to give me a bit of a break. I was kind of nervous. Yes. Anyways, but yeah, so I finally found a spot, parked the car, and we walked onto the beach, and I had a nice blanket out. I think I even had lanterns, or I had a lantern, I'm pretty sure.
Yes.
And
you were very prepared.
As always. And anyways, set up this blanket, and yeah, we ended up having this beautiful picnic. We were kind of full at that point, because we already ate a full meal. But I proposed and Jess said yes. I feel like our recollections are a little different. She says I just leaned right in and started kissing her. I'm sure I waited for an answer and I'm not, anyways.
It's hard to know now.
It was 16 years ago.
And we're tired.
Well, congratulations, guys. So if you're just tuning in for the very first time, I'm on a road trip from California. I went up the West Coast and I went east and I've stopped in Winnipeg. I'm going to be here for about a month. But all along the way, I've been doing podcasts with my friends and sharing their incredible stories, whether it feels incredible to them or not. It seems incredible to me. So tonight I'm going to be talking with Jessica and Ian. And we actually received, after the last podcast, we received a question from Andrea Pavkov. And so she was asking if Jessica and Ian, if you guys could share a little bit about adjusting to life in North America. And that's because you lived in Malawi for a while. And maybe what advice you could give to me as I reintegrate for these few months. And then she also asked another question about what drew you to live in community. And so we'll talk about that in a little bit because I'm not visiting you at your house. I'm visiting you somewhere different, at your church, actually. Mm. So we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But before we can answer Andrea's questions, we need to talk a little bit about your backstory. So, Ian and Jessica, in the last podcast with you, Jessica, we talked about you guys got married and in September of 2001. Mm-hmm. And then you guys went straight over to Malawi to work as missionaries, but also doing some development work.
Yeah, that's what we did. We moved to Malawi 2 months after we got married. And what we did right after the wedding is we went around visiting different family members, which is quite the story, and also raising support so that we would be ready to leave in November.
Yeah, and the way I remember it is I got to meet a lot of Jessica's family along the way. So in those 2 months, right after we got married, and we did get married in 2001 on September 1st. Okay, and then right after that, we had September 11th. And we were actually supposed to fly that day. So part of our story was going to California, visiting Jessica's grandma and a few other of her relatives, and then visiting her aunt and uncle up in Washington State.
Okay, so what Ian is maybe not sure if he can say, but it's fine to say, is that we were going to visit my mom in prison in Southern California. That's where Ian, maximum security prison, my sweet mom. We drove down to Southern California. A very colorful ride we enjoyed with her ex-husband. And yeah, that's where Ian met my mom. And I'll let him tell you a bit more.
Yeah, so when we arrived down to the prison, it was like an 8-hour drive. So we drove all the way through the night because visiting hours was only a specific day and for a specific amount of time. So when we arrived, we met this guard, and she said to us that our paperwork hadn't gone through or they couldn't find it. So it was kind of chaotic right when we arrived. And I remember her being very actually mean to Jessica. Like, she even said to her, like, if you love your mom, you'll stay another day. And Jessica ended up crying. Anyways, and I didn't know what to do with a new crying wife. But anyways, so
outside of prison.
Yeah, outside of prison. We felt like we were inside of prison, the way we were being treated. But anyways, so the bottom line, she said to us, like, there was an office further up the hill, and she said, we'll go in there and redo the paperwork, and we'll see if we can get through today. Because we explained that we were traveling and we couldn't come back. But in the meantime, she mentioned that I was wearing prison-issued colors. So I was wearing a white T-shirt with blue shorts on the bottom. And Jessica was wearing like a spaghetti strap shirt or a tank top. And they said either way, you couldn't bring that into the prison or you couldn't wear that into the prison. So they sent us into this back little room. It had a closet with a few items.
Yeah, I always say that they're like the worst of what you would find at a thrift store. The things that don't sell were all in the closet. And, you know, we might have had 15 items to choose from.
Yeah, no more than 15 for sure. So what happened was I was trying to find a new shirt and a new pair of pants. So the pair of pants I found were way too big. And I actually ended up having to find like a shoestring to tie it up as a temporary belt just to visit Jessica's mom. And the pants were too short. So, and then also the shirt was too tight. And what happened was the where the cuffs came down were kind of halfway between my wrist and my elbow. And it was so tight that I couldn't even bend my arms. So I was like kind of this stiff robot walking around. And Jessica came out with this really ugly gold silk blouse from, I don't know, the 1960s. And she had to wear that as well. So we waited. It ended up taking us 7.5 hours, I think. Like, I vaguely remember I think the visiting hours were about eight hours. But we only had half an hour to spend with her mom. So, but the funny part was we were trying to rush through, and they said you could bring in, I think it was up to $100 in certain denomination bills or something. But we just tried to get through as quick as possible. So luckily, I didn't bring any money in because there was this guy walking around with a Polaroid camera that would take our picture. And I'm glad to say there's absolutely no evidence of what I was wearing.
Well, that was lucky or unlucky, because I would love to see that Polaroid.
Yeah, well, my mom was really disappointed because she had hoped to get a picture of us that day. And and it would be fun to have, but I think, yeah, maybe it's for the best.
So, Ian, you survived meeting Mom in the maximum security prison. Maybe we'll talk about that on another podcast. But eventually you made it to Winnipeg, right?
Yeah, so after that, we traveled up to Washington State to visit our aunt and uncle, and then we eventually got to Winnipeg. 2 months later, we were on our way to Africa, and yeah, and I remember our first time. So when we got to Africa, it was like our first time doing a lot of things as a married couple. We were grocery shopping together. We were setting up our first house together in a completely foreign country, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
Well, they say your first year of marriage is the hardest. So are you telling me it was all a fairy tale?
No. it was definitely full of challenges. And just a few minutes ago, we were looking at each other and wondering when it gets easy. So, yeah.
Are you telling me it doesn't get easy?
Someone else will have to tell us that information.
Yeah, I don't think it gets easier. I think it's a constant learning, as a good friend of ours puts it, to dance together, the dance of life, leaning into each other and leaning out. You guys are laughing at me. But anyways,
I think it sounds romantic.
Yeah, it should be romantic. You know, I'm trying with this romance thing. But anyways, you know what? It's a lot of give and take. I think that's what it boils down to.
Yeah, it wasn't a fairy tale, but we agree that we wouldn't have it any other way as far as moving to Malawi right away. We got to know each other really well. We were, Ian was my only friend, and I was his only friend at the time. And so, yeah, there's a mixture in there because there's a lot of loneliness then, but also, you know, for most of our time in Malawi, there wasn't a lot pulling at us socially. And that's a lot different than our life now.
One thing I do remember, too, is cultural, where, you know, like we were told we couldn't hold hands in public. Oh. We weren't allowed to, obviously, be physical culturally there. So that also added a layer of, you know, like, how do we walk through this together? How do we, you know, display love to each other, but in a way that really culturally, you know, we were sensitive because as we were there, we didn't want to disrespect anybody. And of course, just moving there, we wanted to make a good impact, not a bad one.
Jessica, I just heard you go, oh, as if you were remembering that. What was that memory you just had?
Yeah, I forgot. And I really think that probably put a lot of stress on us because I would just be like, oh, I don't even know if you love me. Just because of this hand-holding thing that I would never really think of anymore. But he just couldn't touch me or be, I don't know, loving in that way toward me if anyone else was around.
So is that like a Malawian culture thing? Because I know that like even in the Middle East, like today where I just came from Iraq, I think you do see couples out holding hands a little bit more. And I think of that as quite a conservative culture. Mm. And yet you do see it there.
Yeah, I mean, I think in Malawi it's progressed a lot. Like, I mean, this was in 2001. When we arrived, there was actually no cell phones. Mm. And we were living rurally. Like, we were 2.5 hours out of the main city in very rural, in a very rural village setting. So I think that had something to do with it. But I think a lot of it has, like, nowadays you see a lot more women in the cities wearing trousers instead of skirts as opposed to back then culturally.
Yeah, so changes all around. Also, we were working with older missionaries who had been there a long time, and that's what they told us.
Hmm. So how long were you in Malawi altogether?
We sometimes debate about this, but we were there for a total of 7 years.
Oh my goodness, that's like, I was going to guess 4. Gosh, where does, like, I can't even believe that.
Yeah, you didn't know that?
Like, I know that, but like, it's hard to believe that the total was 7. That's like so many.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we ended up working for 2 different organizations. So the first one we worked for 3 years. We had a 3-year commitment. And then we actually came back because as we stayed there longer, we realized some very specific things that we wanted to to implement in our, you know, humanitarian work, in our religious work, all that kind of stuff. And as you're there longer, you realize some of the things that work, some of the things that don't. So we ended up finding another organization that was locally planted there from a missionary family, three-generation missionary family, that started a ministry just close by. But we came back to Winnipeg for about 2 years or a year and a half, I can't remember. I think a year and a half, as we were raising support and changing. We had to figure out all the tax stuff, how we could funnel money into Malawi legally, all that kind of stuff, because we weren't supported by an organization that was actually established in North America.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things that you said that has prompted me to have a couple of questions. So, you know, my background is that I went to Bible missionary school with you guys, and then I didn't really ever become a missionary. I did a couple of short-term things. But most recently, my work falls under humanitarian work, specifically relief work. And sometimes where I work, there are also missionaries in the same area that might have been there for a longer time. So they have an ongoing work. And lots of times that's worked really well. And the impact is fantastic, whether it's a clinic or a hospital. Well, that's what I'm familiar with from the places where I've worked. But I know that I've also read other accounts of where missionaries and humanitarians have worked in the same area, and it hasn't gone so well, where maybe the entire community thought everyone was a missionary, and it ended up backfiring and being negative on the secular NGOs. So can you explain a little bit about what you guys did and your perspective on maybe that the tension between missionary work and humanitarian?
Yeah, sure. So just to give you a bit of background, when we arrived in Malawi in 2001, there was a pretty big famine that happened. So when we arrived, we kind of got directly thrown into relief work, where we were doing stuff like handing out food. We were trying to create food for work. So we had some fields that villagers from around our area could come in and work and then get food back, that sort of thing. But we realized, or at least I realized long term, that's not a sustainable way of helping the country or helping the people. They become very dependent on you giving them food, and it doesn't really create ownership or a desire even to provide for themselves. And maybe they can't, but it creates that cycle of where they're dependent on the organization themselves. So that was one example that we realized when we were switching organizations. We wanted to find a different organization that kind of had a lot longer sustainability focus, and even on a smaller scale. Like, the second organization we worked for was called Kindle Orphan Outreach, and they really focused on smaller working with the individual themselves. So either with a family or a smaller group. And they might have not had a big impact across the country, but we were able to actually establish a lot better, a lot more sustainable ways of providing food and those kind of things.
You know, a lot of what I hear often from other humanitarians is that they believe that that missionaries only give assistance and give the gospel at the same time, that it's contingent, that you have to come to church or you have to do something to receive the assistance. So they see it as sometimes a little bit manipulative. Was that your experience, or how would you answer that from somebody who has that question?
I definitely understand that, and I think historically that happened and it continues to happen in the mission field. But I wouldn't say that that's all. Like, for both organizations, just to clarify what Ewan was saying, both organizations we worked for did, kind of long-term work that would help people become self-sufficient. So it isn't to say that Teen Missions wasn't doing that, and so we went to Kindle. Just Kindle had a higher emphasis on that, and we realized that's where we wanted to put our energy. And Teen Missions is huge, and they do so many things. I definitely agree that that missionaries have kind of had that reputation, and that happens within church ministry often.
Ian, do you have any insight?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, like Jessica said, you know, both of the ministries we worked for, the organizations we worked for, had some emphasis on spiritual impact. I would say with Kindle, though, like, I mean, my main position there was, well, it started as head of community development, so I did very little in regards to, you know, evangelizing, that sort of thing. It was more directly related to very basic skills like washing your hands and how to cook food properly and cleaning dishes with hot water, all sorts of stuff like that. But I knew, and something I learned from the first 3 years is really gaining the trust of the people before you can really do any kind of impactful work long term. Like, I know, I remember one story where I went into a village and we were talking about even getting a borehole drilled, and we did some solar irrigation sites that would help them long term again. But I remember them being very hesitant and kind of pushed back, and it turned out that they had multiple NGOs come in, do surveys, gather information, but they would never come back. So I could see why the people, if you talk to them directly, could potentially feel manipulated. And there potentially could even be a misunderstanding on both ends. We might go in with one idea, but they could also feel that we're coming in for another.
Yeah, and I think that you do, you know, you guys were there long term, so you do have a better chance to establish relationships with people, so that you know, you're working and they're your friends, and there isn't so much of a do this, you know, and I'll give you this. Mm-hmm. It's based out of friendship, and that's just how we would hope to do life anywhere.
Yes. For example, the second organization we were working for, we followed the community health evangelism model, which is known as CHE, and that had a lot of focus on actually not just handing out stuff or giving people things where they felt maybe manipulated, but it was a lot more about what resources did they have, what could they contribute to a project, or and often it was maybe even just labor, in the sense of, okay, they have the time, the manpower, but they might not have the materials, which was something we provided. But we really tried to encourage not giving them things for free to avoid that manipulation feeling, but a lot more focus on, let's see what the community has, how can we come together and work together in partnership.
And doing that, you would form a team of people, and it would be up to that team meeting with their community to decide what kind of project they were going to do to help the community. So we weren't going in with the ideas.
Yeah, we felt much more like facilitators than the one that was driving it. And the more and more we were there, the less and less I wanted to be the front person, and I really wanted to step back and give our national staff and really hope to see them succeed to the point where we didn't even need to be there, because that was our ultimate goal, I feel like. I mean, in the sense of, you know, I really did feel equal to my Malawi partners, and a lot of the time, even initially, like going back to initially when Jess and I got there and the first few months, I really remember us spending a lot of time with our national staff, like our Malawian friends, really in their homes, sitting around listening to music, eating, you know, dried fish, and just chatting and really getting to know each other. But I did really try to see us as equals and really work from that standpoint, as opposed to, you know, us coming in from a Western culture with better ideas or a better way of doing things and trying to tell them how to do things.
Yeah, on that note, you know, previously we were talking about what missionaries have done that some humanitarians find troubling. And I think it's good to just say and admit that the church has caused damage, and historically was a part of colonialism. And that's why we talk about things like equality. You know, we've done wrong in that way. And yeah, I think it's good to name it.
Yeah, I get like the chills, like three waves of chills just to say it out loud, you know. And I mean, I read so many missionary books as a child, probably starting when I was, I don't know, 10 or 11. And so those books were like they framed my narrative of everything. Like, I only thought you could be a missionary, right? Like, I didn't even know what a humanitarian was, but I knew what missionaries were because I had read so many books. And so I want to give credit to all of those amazing people who, you know, left and went to Africa in the, what, 1800s, and they packed their belongings in their coffins because back then you couldn't fly back and forth, and you went one time and you knew that there was a strong possibility you wouldn't make it home, that you could get sick or whatever, and they went anyway. Mm-hmm. And they did fantastic things, but we also had the other narrative, which was that we sometimes did things wrong and that we were part of a system that oppressed people. And so there's two stories. And so I just want to acknowledge that too. But thank you, Jessica, for saying it and for saying it out loud. Now to get back to Andrea's question. So she asks, you know, after you finally came home after 7 years, you know, do you have any tips for adjusting to life in North America? And then maybe you can even say, Jessica, to piggyback on this idea of colonialism, and how it impacted you personally, how it, you know, how you thought about it, maybe what your reasons were for actually coming home after those 7 years.
Wow. So we came home after 7 years. You know, it was a few months after we had our third child. And so we had three kids under four. And Ian was now the director of Kindle Orphan Outreach. The previous director had moved to Australia with his family. And that was never a part of our hopes or plans. We planned to work in partnership with them. They're our dear friends, and we blessed them in going, but we were overwhelmed. And we were overwhelmed in two ways. So Ian, with being the director, at that point I was at home with three babies and was not helpful. And I was overwhelmed with that narrative of equality and also just very theologically confused. So it was time for us.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Malawi is a very difficult place to work. And I think as you spend more and more time there, you know, whether we knew it or not, we were probably not as healthy as we thought we were. And you know what, it took a lot of conversations. I remember talking to our good friend Tom, who actually still works there. They live in the UK right now, but they do go back and forth, and they do great work with the staff, and some of our staff that was with Kindle actually moved over there and is now directing that organization. But you know, he really sat us down and we talked a lot, and I think it helped, you know, through those conversations, it really helped to realize and give us permission. Because I think on the other side of it too is the whole stigmatism and this feeling of, wow, you're doing such great work over there. You're almost glorified in the sense of a missionary, and to leave that and come back. And I remember when we came back, I really had this feeling of you could really kind of hide amongst, I don't know how to say it, but you know, in your own culture, like, you know, people in Malawi noticed you. You were driving around, you were white, and you were noticed. You came back to Canada, and I was just one of many people. And anyways, and I think it was initially hard to make that decision, just walking away from. And I think Jess and I both had this idea, like, we wanted to live overseas. We built a house over there. Like, we were ready to live there quite a long time. And before we left, we sold all our belongings, and so we were pretty committed. But I think after having good conversations with Tom, we just realized, you know what, we need to step back and get ourselves healthy, because if we're not healthy, we're really not impacting people the way we would like to be or the way we should be.
And I think that's something that any humanitarian can relate to as well. You know, lots of us go from, we might not be in one place for as long as you guys were, but we might be working overseas for the same amount of time. And we just maybe go from one contract to another contract. And for me, I definitely have a strategy of like, I can't solve the problems in this project, so I'm going to like not renew this contract and I'm going to jump to the other one. I maybe shouldn't confess that out loud, but it's totally a strategy for me. But yeah, and I'm taking a break after only 4 years, and where I feel like I'm kind of in a good place and where I could go back. But I don't think I would be able to go back and be healthy if I didn't take a long break right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we need that. Like, I think we, you know, it's hard sometimes to admit, like you've said, but I think if we're actually being real with ourselves and honest and truthful, we need time to recover from some pretty traumatic experiences. Like, we were held at gunpoint in Malawi at one point. We were robbed. I had a shotgun to my head, like all those kind of things. And I know, Jennifer, some of the things that you've seen, same thing. It's experiences where I don't think at the time you really think about it. And especially in those environments, you kind of push through, you suppress your feelings, you suppress, a lot of your emotions. And it takes a very long time when you come back to actually let those things be released and kind of face and work through them and talk about them, as opposed to trying to get over it in a sense.
So how did you do it? What did you do when you first got back?
I was afraid of this question because I wanted to say we did it poorly. And I think that's true. We did it poorly, but also to the best of our ability. We did our best at the time. So, yeah, I mean, any family with three young kids will remember that time is very cloudy, and we were making major transitions. So, we were surrounded by family and friends in Winnipeg, so we had a good support system here. And then, yeah, we just started making a go of a normal Canadian life.
So what I heard you say is that you did have a good support system, but that you did it poorly. So are you saying that the responsibility wasn't on the community, but that maybe you guys failed to take some steps to integrate, or what do you mean by that?
Well, when I say we had a good community, it's true, but it wasn't huge, you know, and we didn't have a lot of good friends that were our age. Most of those people who I'm thinking of were Ian's parents' friends, and they prepared the house for us and made sure that there was lots of food. And so as far as resources, we had what we needed, but we didn't necessarily have good, solid relationships with people our own age.
And Ian, since I've been here, you have said that it took you about 4 years of being back to really feel settled.
Yeah, because in some ways, when I left, I was 18 and went to Florida and then went straight overseas. So when we came back for this longer period of time, that was the first time I was kind of reintegrating in regards to even seeing where my friends were at. Like, they already had kind of a 10-year head start where they invested in houses, they had decent jobs, that sort of thing. And when I came back, I remember having to work two or three jobs just to, you know, maintain our rent and that sort of thing. And of course, I put a lot of stress and stuff on Jess to be home with the kids, you know, and I was making minimum wage at that time. So you felt like you're working all the time and your paychecks are brutal. But anyways, all that to say, it did take a very long time to get to the point, first of all, where we could see that that we needed help outside of ourselves. So whether it was through counseling, whether it was through finding really good community, a strong community that could be honest with you. Because I think it's one thing for people just to say, oh, yeah, you're doing fine or whatever. But when you actually really need to talk about the hard stuff and you, yeah, like being honest with yourself and being honest with others was a huge step for us. But it takes a long time to be able to open up to that.
So, you know, did you like talking about your experiences in Malawi? Like, did people ask you how it was, or did you just have surface stories that you told all the time as like go-tos, or, you know, how did you just handle people asking you about your life in Malawi?
Yeah, I feel like initially, it was still excitement. We showed pictures, we got to tell, like, talk to people. I mean, but on some level, it slowly wore off. It became like, you know, okay, Ian and Jessica are back, and we just started, you know, getting back into the normalities of Canadian life or whatever. But I think we still needed more support, and we still needed to talk about the deeper things. So initially, yeah, like, for sure, we talked a lot about our experiences and what we did and the excitement of being back. Like, my family was probably really excited that we were back, but we didn't ever get to the really emotional, traumatic or whatever the word may be, like the deeper stuff and talk through that kind of stuff and work through it.
Yeah. And so we had a dear friend, Tom, who we already mentioned, who did say to us leaving Malawi, and he was older than us and just a really good mentor. Anyway, he said to us, you know, you guys need to go back and you need to get healing. So when he said that, we knew that was true, but we didn't know how. And so it took a long time for us to discover how to do that.
And Jessica, I mean, you mentioned just briefly that when you left Malawi, you were in a place of theological doubt, mm-hmm. is what you just said. So you had been missionaries for 7 years, mm-hmm. and it's assumed that you were there to somehow share the story of Jesus with people, mm-hmm. and yet now you're going through some sort of doubt. Mm-hmm. So how was that coming back to a place where people expected you to be probably at church every Sunday, and they expected you to still be the missionary?
Mm-hmm. So hard. I continued to go to church every Sunday, and I have my whole life, because I just have not been able to leave. But, you know, I was still in serious doubt. So, what was happening for me is I was going to church and panicking because I didn't believe it. I just didn't believe what I was hearing anymore. And so that was a long journey. And I think healing did come to me by being like by facing that journey. I don't think you know, I am definitely not saying that I went off course for a while. I think I was on course, and I needed to face the questions that I had, and be honest with them, and that might take longer for some of us than others, but yeah. And I still have them, like, mostly now I just live with it. I'm like, yeah, I doubt every day, but it's okay.
Yeah, and people at your church even know that, right? Because you've gotten up and you've, you know, shared, I think, poems about doubt, and you have, like, some amazing talents with the spoken word, and, you know, I'm just so proud of you for who you have become, you know, and it's not like you're hiding who you are or hiding your doubts, and I think that's something that we need both in the Christian and in the secular world. Mm.
Yeah, and I would totally agree. And I think that was part of the healing process of being able to admit, like, where we were at. And I think, you know, it's harder for some of us than others. Like, when I came back, I didn't go to church. I was like, I don't really, you know, I don't know if I struggled in a different way, because when we left Malawi, I really saw a lot of examples that I didn't want to be like. You know, I came back saying, you know, if this is what Christianity is, or this is what it means to be a missionary, I don't want any of it. And you know, I think I had a lot harder time with pretending. I don't know if I want to say pretending to Jessica, but like, yeah, like hiding how I felt. Like, I'm definitely a much more outspoken, like, if I don't agree with something, I'll let you know. So we processed it in our own ways, and it obviously probably caused some tension even in our own relationship, but I think we've come to the same point where we realize now that we you know, we can be a bit more honest about how we feel and who we are, and it's okay. Like, we're not, you know, we were missionaries. We might not be labeled missionaries anymore, but in our own way, we are getting the healing and the self, and like becoming who we want to be.
So I guess that brings us to the second part of Andrea's question, which is, now you are living in community. You moved into your church. So we've just talked about going through this whole phase of doubt, and Ian, you not going to church at all. But now you've been living inside your church for 2 years. I mean, who does that? That's like, I've never heard of it until you did it. And you had a beautiful house before. I think when you first told me about this, I was a little bit like sad that when I would come to visit, there would be no house.
I know.
But I actually love it here. So you guys are live, like, where we are, we're in a building, a big church building, with a sanctuary downstairs. And then there's two floors, right, of, like, some of them are dorm rooms and some are like apartments. So you guys are in an apartment, and right now, for the month that I'm here, you've put me downstairs in a lovely like bedroom that has a bathroom and a little couch and everything. So it's kind of like a studio, but with no kitchen. And you guys do communal meals sometimes, once a week. Mm-hmm. So tell us about where we are. Like, even why are we here? Why are we in the church? What part of town are we in? What is going on?
Yes, we're in a place called Flatlanders Inn, okay? And it was started through the Vineyard Church. We are located at Main and Sutherland, which is pretty much the heart of downtown. The north end is just north of us, and in some ways it's considered the more dangerous area of town. It has some stigmatisms around it in that sense. It's not the easy part of town, I guess. But yeah.
Yeah, and the church is planted here, you know, with intention. And so so it starts with the Vineyard Church, and then Flatlanders is a ministry that grew out of that. Also, right here where we live, there's, you know, high homeless population. And so the church does a lot of work with that group of people. Those are our people. That's where we are. And so, you know, I see Flatlanders as like providing, seeing a need in the community where we are, and then coming up with a creative way of bringing like sustainability to this area. So it's not unlike some of the humanitarian work we've been talking about.
Okay, so it's not just church families that live here though, right?
Right, yeah. It's really open to all. Anyone could apply to live at Flatlanders, and they don't have to be a part of our church community. They don't even have to be Christian.
So you're in a part of town where there is a lot of homelessness, so you might have people applying to live here who might be transitioning out of homelessness, right?
Yeah, that's the main point, is providing homes for people who are trying to get their feet back under them. And having a mixture of people that live here. And so you have, you know, Ian and I, we're trying to get our feet back under us in some ways, but we didn't have a housing crisis. So we chose to sell our house and to move here. And, you know, we're active members of our church community. To be a leader here, you need to be. So So you have a mixture of people living here, and it's like that to attempt to provide a good nurturing environment for someone who is trying to recover from whatever situation they've been in.
Yeah, I really like the interaction we have, and it's been, again, like whether we're overseas or here, it's always, you always think the places that you're going to impact the most or leave a lasting impression or whatever the thought may be, turns out to be the places that teach you the most and you really draw from the most. And I think, you know, this is another way of us expressing our desire to live within equality and live with people, that they might be different than us, or of course there's always certain tensions within the community, but there's also a lot of love and care, and the idea of community is something we seeked out in Malawi as well as here, and I think it's a beautiful thing living together. And you get that little taste of it, community meals, you get to see all of us working together to prepare it, but also clean up and those kind of things. It actually really has been really life-giving to me, and I think to Jess and our family. It's not just us, it's also our kids living within community. And of course, as we talk to them, there's lots of pros to them living here as well. And being able to be impacted by others and not just their parents.
Yeah, and Jennifer was able to be with us tonight for her first community meal. So I'm wondering what your take on it was.
Oh, it was really nice. I was a little bummed I didn't get to help you cook as much as I wanted because I missed it. I was like downstairs. It was fantastic lasagna. I got to give the credit to Jessica for that because it was her turn to cook. But homemade bread made from scratch by, what was his name?
Gord.
Such delicious bread. Yeah. And it was just so fun to hear him talk about his creative process for creating it and his passion. I think everybody at the table tonight was passionate about something. The other man across from me talked a lot about politics in just a very informed way. Alan. Yeah. And I think, is he the one that was just doing campaigning here or volunteering? Yeah. So today was election day here in Winnipeg, right? For provincial elections yesterday. But his guy won, the guy he's been volunteering for.
Yay.
And like how excited we are just for him, you know, that he did that. And this is so great. So he's involved. Everybody is like involved, not just here in this home, but also out in the community. And, you know, I just thought that was really excellent. Also, lemon meringue pie for dessert, also made by Jessica, was fantastic.
Yeah, she's a pretty good cook.
All right, guys. Well, I think we've reached our time limit. Thank you so much again for opening up about so many things. I think we talked about, you know, the tension of, you know, being a missionary and wanting to do it right, like in a way that doesn't hurt people. Mm-hmm. And the same in a humanitarian world, we have a principle called do no harm. And I'm sure you've probably encountered that principle as well. So we talked about that, and we talked about leaving and needing rest and doubt, and then just a whole different expression of your faith and your desire to serve people by being and living and bringing your family into your church and living together in community here at Flatlanders. So thank you so much. And I look forward to the other podcasts that we're going to have in the future because we have 3 more weeks together.
Yay.
So if you don't want to miss an episode, be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Voices from the Road. And if you do have any topics or questions that you would like us to talk about, you can message me on Facebook or you can send me an email at robinson.jenniferlee@gmail.com. Thanks and have a good night.